have the delegation under the leadership of the TEMA, who will then introduce the entourage, and then we'll take it from there. Are you going to lead the presentation? Okay, thank you. Where are you at?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Good morning. I will start by introducing the delegation that is supporting me today here.
You had something to say, question?
Yes, we do. On a lighter note, I think it's unfair for this committee, especially myself, to participate in this. We only received the documentation this morning. So what it means is that I will just sit and listen, which is unfair. I think in the future, this is for the record, Mr. Chair, because it's a mandate that we have to pass now to carry on. So it is definitely unfair for the committee to. I don't know how the other honourable feel, but from my point of view, it is. We need to be serious. I appreciate it. Thanks.
On behalf of the chairperson of the select committee, may I apologise to members, because I don't know what happened between the chair and the department and so forth, but I would assume that it's an administrative matter that will be resolved moving forward without belabeling the issue and so forth. But the point is taken that for purposes of preparation and so forth, it's good that the committee must be provided with the necessary information in Kuta. I don't know if that satisfies. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe Chairperson, it might be appropriate to also apologize. We sent the document on Thursday. We assumed that it would have been distributed to members. So we really want to apologize. So we'll look into the processes in the future so that we can use much more efficient process of getting the information to your files. We apologize. Chair and honorable members, the delegation that is accompanying me today are members of the IDT executive and the support. Ms. Rochelle Dwarika is the manager in my office who is administratively supporting us today. I'm with the chief executive. I'm with the chief financial officer, Mr. Tom Moyer, next to myself, said responsible for finances in the IDT. I'm with Professor Edith Fries, who is the executive in the office of the CEO. Mr. Vukani Mtinso, who is the executive responsible for integrated services at the IDT. And Mr. Popo Maja, general manager responsible for stakeholder management. And Vusi Moy, who is our manager for stakeholder. Firstly, thank you, honorable members, for affording us the opportunity to interact with yourself. We take this process very seriously to be able to put forward the work that we do as an organization and, of course, to receive guidance from yourself. The content of our presentation would be to look into the compliance statement, the general overview of the work that we do, our 2010-12 corporate strategy, the partnerships, long-term sustainability, and the concluding comments. Honorable members, in terms of the compliance statement, our 2010-12 corporate plan is prepared in compliance with the Chapter 29 of the Treasury Regulations, Section 52 of the PFMA, which enjoins government departments and public entities to prepare a three-year corporate plan, and the structure complies with the National Treasury 2008 Practice Note on the submission of corporate plans. We assumed, Chair, that we should really present to yourself from the beginning in terms of who IDT is. So the overview will cover the institutionalization of IDT from its inception. The IDT is a trust, as you said, Chairperson, earlier. It is also a development agency, and it was established in 1990. In 1997, there was a cabinet decision that was aimed at reviewing the mandate of the IDT. Honourable members would recall that at that stage it was not just the IDT, but it was a number of the institutions that the democratic government had inherited post-1994. That transformation of that mandate read as the IDT must be transformed into a government development agency that will implement projects which are commissioned by government departments. It must cease to be a civil society organization, an independent agency, or a funding agency. I just wanted to recap and go back a bit, because there is a fundamental issue there in terms of how the IDT is going to be responding. The statement said that the IDT is going to be implementing projects which are commissioned by government departments, which means the IDT is going to be reacting to what has been prioritized by the different government departments. It further states that it must cease to be a civil society organization. And I'm assuming that honorable members would recall that the funding for the National Development Agency was actually wholly from the IDT. The 100 million that established the National Development Agency was funded from the IDT. And you'd also see that the mandate was then split, because currently the mandate of the NDA is mainly to support civil society. So that transformation decision was then saying that we need to separate these responsibilities. I think it is important for members just to understand where we come from in terms of the evolution of our mandate as an organization. As said earlier, that the Public Finance Management Act is what governs us as an organization, and that we're a Schedule II public entity. Our accounting authority is the Board of Trustees, and our executive authority is the Minister of Public Works. In 1998, there was also an amendment of the deed of trust, but that was really institutionalizing the mandate that I have already spoken to earlier. And in October 2000, government appointed the IDT to implement what we referred to as the ISRCP, the Integrated Sustainable Rural Development Program. For us, we see this as milestones in the process of the evolution of the mandate of the IDT, where the IDT has been able to respond to the priorities of government. At that stage, the ISRDP was a priority program of government. And in March 2006, the IDT was further appointed by the presidency to support the ASGISA program, which is the accelerated and Shared Growth Initiative of South Africa, excuse me. And in November 2008, we were further appointed to implement the Jobs for Growth program. How we understand our mandate, we thought it was critical for us to interpret that mandate and to operationalize it for implementation. And this is how we understood our mandate. Firstly, to support the social policy agenda of government, and we've put in some of the core issues that are addressed by that social policy agenda, and that is halving poverty and unemployment. That is the creation of decent work and sustainable livelihoods. That is also a very important element for us, because we're not just talking about creation of jobs, or we're not just talking about creating of livelihoods, but we underline that with sustainability and the decent work that we endeavor to achieve. The measurable improvements in the quality of life for all, and this is also a response to the to what we would say is the vision of our democratic government, which is quality of life for all, to say we want to contribute towards the improvement and measurability of the interventions that have been put in. The social cohesion is also one of the deliverables that we have prioritized. We also want to emphasize, honorable members, that the IDT was established as a redistributive mechanism. And maybe just to say a bit on that as well, honorable members are aware that there are a number of institutions that mostly contribute towards the creation of economy, to contribute towards the economic development. But IDT, I would venture to say, possibly it's IDT and NDA that specifically look into the redistribution of that economic wealth that might have been created. And we think that is a critical vehicle, therefore, to achieve the priorities that have been set up by government. And therefore, we support all spheres of government with planning and implementing the National Development Agenda, with particular reference to the eradication of structural intergenerational poverty. employment creation, sustainable development, and sustainable livelihoods, monitoring the effectiveness of interventions, deriving, documenting, and sharing the lessons, which includes interventions initiated, designed, and funded by the IDT. As I've said earlier, honorable members, the IDT's mandate has evolved over the 19 years. Initially, the IDT was a grant-making agency, but it has evolved into a program implementation agency, a development planning and implementation, development integration and coordination, program design, social facilitation, and development innovation. We've also demonstrated the capacity to reinvent ourselves in response to the environment, and we've remained relevant to our mandate. In terms of our business model, again, we're saying it is anchored on the commitment to the eradication of poverty, unemployment, alienation of the majority trapped in the cycle of chronic intergenerational poverty, and confidence in the social policy agenda. We believe that no single institution can do it alone. Government has the resources and the political will. There is the private sector donors who do not necessarily have the reach and experiences, but we also have the poor that do not have the capacity or power to access the resources. Hence, there is a development gap that needs a vehicle, and we think we are the vehicle that operates in that development gap. This is how we depict our business model as an organization, and that is the development gap that we operate in, where you'd see that those are the service agencies on top there, which includes the donors, government, and private sectors, as I said earlier, and then we've got the targeted population. Quite often, you find that both parties, there is something that's in common that they require, but there's no one that facilitates that interaction, and we think we operate in that development gap. But we also acknowledge that we're not the only people that operate there. There are quite a number of other role players that operate there. So the challenge for us, therefore, is to distinguish ourselves in terms of how we impact in that operation, in that development gap. The vision of the IDT is to be the leading knowledge-based development agency. And honorable members might ask and say, how do you measure this? How are you going to be a knowledge-based development agency? We believe that through the models that we conceptualize, the models that we pilot and test, we will be able to say we are a knowledge-based development agency, because we would have been able to have tested those programs in terms of how they respond to the social policy of government. In terms of our mission, we say that the IDT with strategic partners will enable poor communities to access resources and to recognize and unlock their own potential to continuously improve the quality of their lives. Again, we think our mission statement, it's really at the core of what we do. You will see the honorable members that we talk about the communities unlocking their own potential, which means we are saying that we don't necessarily do development to communities, but we enable those communities to be part of that development process. To us, this is core to the work that we do and how we actually implement our programs. Our core business areas, honorable members, we do development program management, and that entails social infrastructure and social development programs. We also have programs of community-based poverty eradication, and that is community-based organization support, sustainable livelihood initiatives, and poverty eradication interventions. We will be giving an example of some of the programs that we are implementing. And thirdly, institutional delivery capacity building, and that is municipal support program, women organization support such as the South African Women in Construction, the South African Women in Development, the Progressive Women of South Africa. Those are some of the women's groups that we're currently interacting with, and as well as public sector development program and support. Going further, honorable members, we are outlining here our corporate plan 2010-30, and we're saying these are our strategic objectives. Firstly, is to attain sustainable livelihoods through people-centered development interventions. These honorable members refer to people themselves designing their own interventions, their own aspirations. So we're saying we don't necessarily want to assume what people require, but would want to interact and be informed by the people themselves. to pioneer innovative development solutions. As I said earlier, to be a knowledge-based organization, it's important that we need to be innovative, to incubate, test, and be able to say these are the solutions in terms of development interventions. To ensure excellence in service delivery, and these are mainly the compliance issues and the efficiencies within the organization. We depict that with these ports, honorable members, and we think this encapsulates our overall strategy. Our theme says that together, eradicating intergenerational poverty. And you'd see that in that spoon there, it's the sustainable development solutions that we're saying we are cooking in there. And the methodologies, the IDT methodologies and resources in the port, the partnership and the resources that I've referred to earlier, that we acknowledge that we'll not be able to do that on our own, but we need to be able to partner with other institutions and with the communities as well. They were talking in the middle, were talking about the community aspirations and the assets that the communities have. We don't want to assume that in communities there are no assets, but we want to say how do we enhance those assets so that meaningfully the people can also benefit from that. The fire is the catalytic type of a role that we are playing to say that we are there to catalyze that. In other words, it's not just the IDT resources or the departments that we are working with, but we'll be able to pull resources from all levels to be able to get the pot boiling. So that is how we debate the work that we do. Honorable members, that's an overview in terms of historical backgrounds. I might have spoken to some of these issues, but it is important just to recap that within South Africa, in terms of generally looking into the development sector overall, government has had a number of initiatives, including the DFI review. The DFI review was an initiative of the Department of Treasury trying to look into how the development finance institutions are operating in South Africa, whether there are any overlaps, duplications from the functions of the many DFIs that we have. The IDT was part of those institutions that were reviewed. It was quite pleasing for us that broadly, post the first phase of the DFI review, the IDT was it was concluded that the IDT is meeting its mandate. There are quite a number of other institutions where there had to be review of those mandates, but we were pleased that through that evaluation, we were confirmed to have been in line with our mandate. We're also looking generally into a situational analysis to say what are these things that to some extent informs the strategic shift that we're presenting to ourselves. And we're saying that Universal Compact to Eradicate Poverty in the National Development Agenda affirms international development priorities, for example, the Millennium Development Goals. We're saying that the MDGs are minimalist in nature, i.e. the target for the goal of having the number of people living in extreme poverty is only $1 per day. So in other words, we would like to go even beyond the targets or the measures that have been set up by the MDGs. There is a draft anti-poverty strategy which fundamentally shifts from the minimalist MDG targets and indicators towards addressing chronic intergenerational poverty at household level and which takes account of the racial, spatial, and gender dimensions of poverty. Honorable members are aware that the anti-poverty strategy, if I'm not mistaken, has not yet been adopted. But the contents of that strategy, we think, will be able to even operate far beyond what the MDGs are stipulating in terms of targets. Chronic intergenerational poverty, we are saying that it is poverty that is passed from one generation to the next. That is the most severe form of chronic poverty, can be assessed by comparing the well-being of two generations within the same household. Furthermore, honorable members, we are trying to say this is how we have interpreted and this is what we are saying we want to be achieving with our strategy for breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty. Based on the international best practice, we argue for the appropriate institutional mechanism and IDT's positioning as the dedicated development agency supporting government with the implementation of a comprehensive integrated anti-poverty strategy. We think this is a very important element, honorable members, because all the work that we've been doing, we're trying to really position ourselves as the organization that has the capacity, that has the reach and the experience in terms of being a premier development agency that government can rely on to be able to implement and roll out this particular strategy. In terms of a long-term plan, we say typically best practices in successful poverty eradication confirms that it is only possible to report on impact after a period of 15 to 20 years. It also recognizes the feminization of poverty and role of women. IDT, therefore, is established as the fully-fledged implementation arm in the delivery of the anti-poverty strategy. I've already said that, and that the development agency which designs and pilots innovative approaches to sustainable development and poverty eradication, and also evaluates documents and packages models such that it can be absorbed by line functions and the IDT can initiate innovation processes in a new development challenge. The country will have fundamentally transformed the face of poverty. No further need for a development agency focusing on the eradication of intergenerational poverty. But generally saying, if we can wake up tomorrow and there is no poverty, we'd actually come back to this committee and ask that we don't need the IDT anymore. So unfortunately, we want to measure ourselves and work ourselves out of business. Because if there is no poverty, then we don't have a mandate as an organization. Hence, we want to measure ourselves by breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, and that is the chronic poverty that I've referred to earlier. I think we can go from that. Yeah, I think I've spoken to them. Okay. The key roles. I think honorable members can say, but how are you going to achieve all these things that you are talking about? We're saying we will do it through advocacy, so we will be able to conceptualize programs where we will advocate for the principles that we believe in. In terms of our operational programs, which both is in infrastructure and as well as social development, and the best practice and capacity building. This is how we're going to be rolling out our programs. I have spoken earlier in terms of partnerships, and we're saying that we will be able to leverage funds from multilateral funding agencies, the private sector, global donors, foundations, and the CSI, and as well as government. As well as from the political principals like yourself, we will be able to leverage resources if we are able to demonstrate the type of work that we do. We're also saying that we will be leveraging resources from the communities themselves, and from households, NGOs, and CBOs. In other words, all the resources that are existent will be able to pull that in as the port had depicted earlier. In terms of coordination, we're learning and we're more effective in terms of the experiences that we've had from the ISRDP, for instance. We've been able to unpack that program and look into where were our failures and where our successes and what have we learned from that implementation process. In terms of value add and the competitive advantage of the IDT, we're saying that honorable members were responsive. We think that we are politically legitimate and we are quite recognized as an implementing agent of government. In terms of the program packaging and management, we think we have excelled over the time. We have got very good strategic partners that enhances our development impact, and we've been championing most of the programs that we've had, real greenfield projects that have never been implemented previously. We also have reach and we've engaged the communities that we work with. In terms of advocacy, influencing the overall debates and the development landscape, the development of the National Anti-Poverty Strategy, we have been a partner in the development of that strategy. Actually, that strategy, to a great extent, was informed by the study tour that the IDT undertook to Chile and Tunisia, where we learned the best models. And you would ask and say, why Chile and Tunisia? These are the two countries that have exceeded the MDGs. So we wanted to know how have they done it and how can we learn from those countries. And the fundamentals that underlies that anti-poverty strategy was actually informed by that study too. We've also been instrumental and participated into establishing the provincial anti-poverty strategies and plans, the municipal anti-poverty plans and commitments to targets, and as well as program-specific advocacies. These, honorable members, we might not have achieved in all provinces or municipalities, but in those where we have participated, we think it has worked, and we intend rolling it out in our 2010-30 strategy. The programs that will be implementing its public mandated social infrastructure. With this program, honorable members, we are referring to where we are appointed by departments to be implementing agents on their behalf. And these are going to be fully cost recoverable programs that we will be rolling out. The community mandated social infrastructure are also infrastructure programs that are mandated by the communities, i.e. if a community was to approach us or a department and initiate a program, we would want to be the implementing agent of that. Community-based investment mobilization, also that refers, as I said earlier, to the assets and the information and knowledge that is within the communities that we would want to mobilize so that we can be able to pull it into meaningful impact interventions in our program. The catalytic program management support I referred to earlier, and that is what we really do. We say that our biggest strength is not necessarily resources, but the ability to pull resources as a catalyst and make sure that development does take place. International technical support and exchange programs, we are intending to expand that program. At the moment, we don't have a very strong program in terms of international technical support and exchange program, but we intend intensifying that program. In terms of strategic interventions, these are priority interventions that quite often come from the departments and would want to be geared to be able to respond to that. And then shareholder-directed programs. As we all know, that our shareholder, our sole shareholder, is government. So where government will be directing us to implement programs, we will be geared to respond to that. In brief, honorable members, here we are trying to show you how we have how we are going to put our effort and budget towards our programs, where our focus would be. I've already spoken about the public mandated program, and we have allocated about 40% of our effort to be on that. We're also looking into the IDT and donor-funded programs, and 30% of our effort is going to be focusing on that. And the institutional capacity building, which I referred to earlier, as the advocacy, the development intelligence, institutional delivery capacity, and the international participation to be 30%. So we're generally just showing you how we've distributed the effort or the focus of the organization. The performance indicators, honorable members, in detail, that we can find on page 23 to page 26 of our corporate plan. And it will clearly show what type of indicators we have been able to set up for ourselves. And we would invite honorable members to assist us to sharpen those indicators, because these are the instruments that will assist you in terms of evaluating whether we have met the expectations or what we had promised to deliver. We are on page 12, page 13. And therefore, in summary, we're saying that the IDT has three strategic objectives, of which are aligned to the MTSF priorities, and that is the medium-term strategic framework priorities. And that is, one, to attain sustainable livelihoods through people-centered development interventions, to pioneer innovative development solutions, and to ensure excellence in service delivery. Honorable members, the issue, the following presentation on the budget, my CFO will assist me in that. but maybe just to start with the main slide in terms of the principles that guided us as we were putting together our budget. Firstly, it was the DFI review that I referred to earlier, which was an initiative of Treasury that looked into the rationalization of the development finance institutions, and of course the business case that we're engaged in. Maybe it's important for me to just again give a bit of background to say that in terms of financing, the IDT was financed in 1990 at establishment with the 2 billion endowment that it was given. Throughout the years, the IDT has survived through the investment of that 2 billion rand. And therefore, when we talk about the business case, it's the process that we have engaged in to try and go back to government to request for recapitalization of the IDT. As we sit right now, what we have realized is that we have started tapping on the capital base of the IDT, and therefore, to some extent, we are beginning to utilize that capital base, and therefore we might not necessarily be sustainable. So the business case that we're referring to here is a business case that looks specifically to the sustainability of the IDT. The strategic shift is the shift from our previous corporate plans, where we have been implementing on behalf of government without necessarily charging government for those services. I think what our board was saying to us is that they would want to put IDT money mainly towards development initiatives, and the social infrastructure should be fully funded because Treasury does provide a budget for the implementation of that social infrastructure. And my CFO will talk more onto that. The financial capacity over the MTEF period, what we've done is to outline over the MTEF period how our financial capacity will be. The guidelines, therefore, to our budget has been the fact that we would want our turnover to stabilize. When we talk about turnover, we talk about the reactive appointments from departments to implement mainly social infrastructure, and we would want that to stabilize. Yes, it has been increasing, but we want to be able to cap it at some stage so that we can determine what is the size of the organization that we are running. The salary increases should be aligned to Treasury's MTEF guideline of 6% in 2011, declining to 5% in 2013. So we have stuck on terms of our salary increases to those percentages in terms of the Treasury guidelines. But we will be able to consider contractual escalations, because we can't get out of that one. We need to be able, our budget will have to be able to accommodate that. And our inflation is projected at 10%. And in terms of the community mandated poverty eradication programs, we have to be able to maintain that in the full period of the MTF. Again, a new element that we've introduced is the management fees, which needs to increase to achieve cost recovery, particularly on public mandated infrastructure programs. So these are the principles, honourable members, that has guided us as we were formulating our budget. And my CFO will continue from here.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, CEO. I think in terms of the compilation of the budget, we realized that to facilitate the strategic shift of the organization, it would not be possible to allocate additional resources in order to bridge this transformation period. What we have therefore done is we've actually taken a chunk of our budget, which is quite considerable, of 51.5 million, and we actually ring-fenced that direct community-driven program interventions in the current year. The reasoning behind this is to force the organization to actually implement this transformation directed at community interventions at pace, because we cannot afford the luxury of time in terms of this intervention. The issue around management fees were adjusted upwards in line with new contractual expectations. If one actually does an analysis of the IDT budget, Chair, you will realize that we, from an expenditure perspective, most of our cost is actually directed towards government mandated social infrastructure, and therefore it is imperative for us to actually get our management fees on those programs aligned to actually be able to come to a position of cost recovery. Having said this, the material expenditure increases on the expenditure side was not possible in terms of the MTF period because of the limitations that we are experiencing, and therefore the reliance in terms of the long-term sustainability of the organization was really therefore fixed on the transformation of the operations of the organization. Just a brief analysis of the composition of the IDT budget. You will forgive me, but I didn't break it down into two small chunks, otherwise it becomes too comprehensive and not effective. You will see the staff component of the budget actually exceeds 50%, which in essence indicates that we are a labor-intensive organization. In the development work, you are highly reliant upon people to actually do the work, and that is why the staff cost is that high. We've also highlighted the cost of travel. I think in many organizations, travel is regarded as a luxury. Unfortunately, within the IDT operating in rural areas, travel is in essence our tool of operation. And that is why we are actually also highlighting that. Chair, the other costs which we've described as goods and services is seemingly a huge chunk. This includes all our cost of operations in essence, relating to the rental of offices in all the provinces in South Africa. It also underpins the cost of our communications, our data lines, our telephone services, and all of those other support to ensure the effective integration of our operations nationally. Here, the last item that we're also highlighting is depreciation. You'll see the depreciation cost of the IDT is relatively low. I think that is indicative of the fact that we hold very little assets which can be depreciated. I think if one actually interrogates that and take a position to acquire assets in the long term, you may reduce that 35% chunk of the cost of operations by also releasing the cost of rentals of accommodations countrywide. So in terms of the income and expenditure summary of the budget, I think this is in essence the concern of the IDT in terms of the future financial sustainability of the organization. In 2005, a decision was taken that the application of our capital base towards poverty eradication is the right approach, and it's not the business of the IDT to try and protect its money, because in that way our impact on poverty would actually be minimized. Chair, we are giving the budget and the forecasted expenditure trends in the first line. That is underpinned by the Treasury guidelines given to us in terms of budgeting. We are also projecting our income for the same period, which you will also realize is reducing significantly until 2011, and then it is picking up slightly because of one of the components underpinning the income stream, which is management fees. We have indicated in previous slides that we've taken a deliberate decision to actually increase our management fees in the medium term. Unfortunately, it is taking some time because we are locked into multi-year contracts, which in most cases with government departments does not have a provision for the recovery of management fees. And therefore, it will take approximately 3 years to phase those out until we can actually get new contractual obligations in place with full cost recovery around that. Chair, the investment income stream that you're seeing there is actually reducing up to the last year where it's basically zero. That is indicative of the fact that because of the short term left for investment management, we are mainly into money market and interest-bearing instruments, and therefore we are highly reliant upon the interest rates in the market. Because the capital base is also reducing, you will see that that income stream is diminishing quite significantly up to zero balance at the end. See, the point of concern is the deficit line, which you'll see is fundamentally sitting at a 300 million pitch over the full period. The impact of that is that the closing balance on our investment fund will be reducing from 948 million in the last financial year to 600 in the current year, running to basically a zero balance in 2012, where we will sit with 31 million left only. That in essence means that from a financial sustainability perspective, the IDT will run out of funds at the end of the 2012 financial year unless treasury funding is acquired during that period. I can just mention we have submitted MTF inputs to National Treasury, and we are confident that the Treasury will respond positively in terms of our funding requirements. So moving to the concluding comments on the budget, I think the total budget increase over the period is very conservative and in line with the Treasury guidelines and also the guidelines of the organization. You will notice the allocations is only affordable up to the end of 2012, as I mentioned. Limited capacity exists to significantly impact on the revenue generating capacity in the short term because of the contracts that I've mentioned. The income and expenditure summary, in essence, is the main motivation together with the relevance of mandate of the IDT in terms of poverty eradication to secure the necessary funding from Treasury during this MTF cycle. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Members, I'm taking it again, and I'm going to talk to the issue of partnerships. As I referred earlier, that partnerships is an important component for us to be able to achieve our strategy. And there are quite a number of partnerships that we have currently initiated. If you go back to our mission statement, for instance, that I spoke to earlier, that is the fundamental issue that sits there, and that is partnership. We have had international cooperation partnerships mainly directed at improving the capacity of the IDT and the state to deliver, such as the Kellogg Foundation and the Republic of China, of Cuba. The civil society partnerships directed at gender mainstreaming and the women's empowerment, including the Progressive Women's Movement of South Africa, the South African Women in Dialogue, and the South African Women in Construction. Maybe just to underline the South African Women in Construction, mainly for us, as the Honourable Members are aware, that our biggest portfolio is in construction. One of the things that we observed was that there are very few women participants in that sector. So we then partnered with the South African Women in Construction to try and develop the capacity of women so that we can have more women participating in construction. The South African Women in Dialogue mainly is looking into social development type of programs that are also targeting women in particular and in the rural areas. And I must say that we've got very exciting programs that we have been able to conceptualize in that respect. The Progressive Women's Movement is also a very important structure for us because we believe that with the fragmentation, particularly in women's groupings, we do need to make an effort in getting women to work together because we believe that the strength in women participating on programs of poverty eradication will definitely meaningfully impact on the general social policy agenda of government. and those directed at promoting economic participation, social cohesion, and sustainable livelihoods, which have included economic sector partners, including small and medium-sized contractors, the National Empowerment Fund. We have got a partnership and an agreement with NEF where they assist us with providing capital for contractors that we have appointed, and in particular women. But that program also has a big component of capacity building embedded in it. The Lonmin Platinum, as well as civil society organizations such as Kanya and the SOMAFCO X. Lonmin had appointed us as their PIA, which means we were implementing their social corporate investment budget. And with Kanya, it's more on both us and Kanya benefiting from each other, but also the intensification of our social facilitation program. The SOMAFCO X, it's a youth group that we are working with in terms of mobilizing and supporting most of the youth programs that they've been pursuing, i.e. they assisted us a lot when we were assisting Gauteng in particular on the xenophobia program that we were participating in. Consequently, the IDT is in the process of finalizing its stakeholder and resource mobilization strategy with a view of integrating and synergizing its relations. In terms of long-term sustainability, honorable members, we've touched on these issues. The CFO has also touched on these issues. But generally, I think just to underline to say that overall, for us, sustainability refers to achieving a balance between relevance of purpose, the financial viability, and institutional integrity. Relevance is key for us because it pertains to the IDT's ability to remain relevant and efficient, adding value to the national development priorities through programs and initiatives aimed at redressing, redistribution, and the eradication of poverty. Hence, in terms of our mandates, the IDT offers a unique suite of services which differentiates it from other institutions. We normally say, honorable members, there has to be a difference where IDT has participated and where other private sector institutions have also participated. We want to be distinguished by the impact that we've made within those communities. And when we get into programs, I think we will give you more information in as far as that is concerned. In August 2005, the CFO has referred to that. The IDT took a decision to focus on the sustainability of the organization. And in that, we drew a number of scenarios in terms of what are the scenarios that we think we should be presenting to government in terms of our request for recapitalization. And our first scenario was that the IDT profile its services, and that is the innovative projects designed and implemented by the IDT in which the IDT invests its own money. I referred earlier to community-initiated programs, and I think that is a manifestation of that scenario that we had put forward to the board, which the board then confirmed into our 2010-30 strategy. The service delivery programs, where the IDT renders program implementation in terms of the current turnover programs at full cost recovery, including programs delivered free in the past. Again, I referred to the public mandated programs where departments appoint us to implement on their behalf, and that we will be cost recovering that. The board has concluded that and has taken a decision which is also embedded in our 2010-30 strategy. We also want to be to provide specialist support services, and that is commercial projects where the IDT's expertise and resources are required and important enough for the client to be prepared to pay a premium, i.e. the strategic planning, program evaluation, designing poverty profiles. These were in a process of conceptualizing and coming up with those programs. There were key assumptions that that underpinned those discussions in August 2005, honorable members, and that is the IDT will use its resources to deliver its mandate, invest in innovative models of people-centered development, and create the best practices and success stories in poverty eradication. This would imply that over time, the IDT will substantially reduce the capital base, as we've said. However, in doing so, the IDT would be able to demonstrate its effectiveness to the shareholder and the citizen, and its effectiveness and impact, will that persuade decision makers of the effectiveness of the IDT and the need for the recapitalization? So we're appealing to honorable members to realize that without this recapitalization, the IDT will not be able to impact at scale or to be able to roll out the programs that we've been talking to up till now. Currently, we have put up a number of cabinet memos to cabinet. Our minister is interacting with cabinet to that effect, and all those memorandums are requesting government to be able to recapitalize the IDT or for the IDT to come online. Coming online, honorable members, means that the IDT be getting a budget from the Department of Public Works, which is currently our executive authority. There is also a technical process on developing the business case, and I'm sure honorable members are aware that the business case will have to go through a number of processes, including the Department of Public Service Administration, the Treasury, and get the go-ahead or acknowledgement at that level for it to be able to be tabled at cabinet. And therefore, we are canvassing support from this committee to support us on that bid. We maybe get some guidance from yourself, Chairperson, whether we should conclude or to pause at this level. We've got selected program information that specifically would be talking to the practical implementation of programs on the ground. So we could either finish off that or we could pause at this stage. Maybe give us the guidance, Chairperson. Should we continue? We should continue. Thank you, Chairperson. My executive, Mr. Mtinso, will take us through the selected program information.
Thank you, Chair. May I request, Chairperson and honorable delegates, your own sympathy, because it's often difficult to present after the CEO or the CFO. The CEO, 9 out of 10 times, you're bound not to hit it there. You're bound to miss it. On the rare occasion, if you get it right, you might just get fired for being too good. So I would appreciate your own sympathy there. Our current program outline is in those three areas around development program management. I think in general it's the public image that honorable delegates would have seen on the social infrastructure programs. You know, your schools construction, hospitals, and those type of facilities. The second suit, if you like, around that is around social development directed initiatives. We've put them separately for convenience. But in reality, when you deliver those services, when you build a school, you also bring out the social development outcome. So we've just done it for convenience. But I can assure you that the value chain integrates the two. The second suite of offerings around the community-based poverty eradication programs. And this is essentially about finding out or finding those initiatives that communities themselves are engaged in and then elevating them to the next level. There's often a development mistake of assuming that there's nothing in communities, and so we construct different things that are required there. So the suite of offerings looks at actually building on those initiatives run by those communities and improving on those. The third area is around institutional delivery capacity, and we all know that in terms of local-level institutions, municipalities in particular, and community organizations in particular, there's a whole lot of support that we give in that particular area through our municipal support program, as well as supporting the women organizations that this year talked about. The third area around that in institutional capacity building is around public sector development programming support. A good example that you can look at is around the expanded public works program, wherein there are institutional challenges sitting within that program in terms of meeting the target. And so the IDT comes in to give some programming support around those particular areas. Our basic service delivery model is really in two categories. Category one is where the IDT renders program implementation support on behalf of a client department. Typically here, the Department of Education would say would like to build this number of schools in a particular area. But because it doesn't make business sense for private sector to go to the outlying parts of South Africa, the IDT then comes in and assists in that particular area. And so that's one category. The second category is what we call profile services, which is really interventions that we design and develop with our partners, in particular communities, and deliver on those. And here, and you would have heard the CFO referring to us employing IDT resources. This is exactly where we employ those particular resources. In terms of our growth portfolio, I think you can look at the slide previously. I think what I would like to highlight is that, you know, in about 9 years, we've grown tenfold. In terms of our own impact and in terms of our application of the portfolio. So that's the growth rate. In terms of achievements, we've highlighted those achievements, and I think you can see them there. But I wish to highlight that if you look at our attainment in terms of expenditure targets, as well as our contributions to the total target, what we'll jump at is that we're investing in rural South Africa. So the majority of where we're sitting with higher targets and where we've invested most of our resources sits in those provinces that are largely rural, which then confirms that the IDT is actually in the rural development space. In terms of the delivery of programs, if we're to break down what kinds of programs we looked at, you will see that 55%, and that's the pie chart on the bottom right, 55% of our investment is around school building and supplies. This confirms the priority that says education for all. This is a priority that was predicted previously, and we've invested in, and we will continue to invest in, because, as we said, a sustainable model is what we're looking for in education as a critical part within that particular area. The second biggest category, as you will see, is around welfare support facilities. And that's quite important, because that's the social net, if you like, that assists those communities to lift themselves out once educated, if not educated as well. That's generally what you can pick up from our program delivery performance over the years. In terms of our capacity, we are sitting in all the 9 provinces, so we have offices in all the 9 provinces. The core team of program management staff is got professionals that are sitting there. Some are drawn from the private sector, some are from the public sector. We've also have a proven competent program management skill, and we've got that development experience. We're still calculating collectively what that experience is in the organization, but I can assure you it's hundreds of years that are sitting in development experience. We've also got sound financial management systems, 7 unqualified audit reports in consecutive years, and I know many others have a different story to tell around audits, but we have a positive one to tell. In terms of our management systems, we've got excellent management systems. If you look at our electronic program management systems, Kitimang and so forth, these are various programs that assist in tracking development and delivery. Also, we've got world-class project planning and management methodologies. More and more provinces, departments, are actually engaging us to assist them to plan delivery of the programs. So the conceptual high-level understanding is there, but the actual sitting down and saying this is what we need to achieve, that's where it's lacking. So we're doing a lot of work in that space most recently. We also then have employed a community-driven approach, if you like, utilizing the 3 principles of sustainable livelihoods. So, you know, if you go to an IDT or a community where the IDT has been working with that community, you will not just find the school or the hospital. You will find the school and the hospital and various other developments around that. So we use that social infrastructure as an entry point or as an attraction point, and then develop various community-directed initiatives within there. We've taken the mud and unsafe school structure backlog as an example. These are the statistics we received in 2006 around undesirable structures, totaling about 8,500 throughout the country. We've categorized them by province and in terms of areas. Then we looked at the budgets over the MTFs that were to address those particular areas, and those I'm sure honorable delegates will be quite aware of in this particular committee. But these are the allocations that are sitting in the MTF around the baseline that were earmarked for education broadly, but also in particular around the allocation of these indesirable structures. When we looked at these figures, And this is round about the time, as the CFO says, when we made the conscious decision of application of resources. We said we could not, as an IDTC or a development agency, unless we actually reversed this picture in terms of the undesirable structures. So as an example, we put aside $150 million that would then be invested. Now, there's an example of one of the schools, Dalit Sodhan Nyandeni in the Eastern Cape. This is the school as we began. Those little structures there, this is a classroom that's sitting there, and all the kids would study there. The road, I must say, going up there is not one of the best roads. It takes something that should take you 30 minutes to drive from the main tar road will take you about 3 hours to get down to that particular area. So we drove right to the outback there, and we found this particular structure. Next slide, please, Edith. And now this is, if you go down that road again, it still takes the same distance to get there. But this is the structure you're bound to find there. Now, we can give you the tangibles because you can see the pictures. But the intangibles around the actual development that has come through that, I would propose that honorable delegates should take time to sit with the children of Dalit Soga and the principal of Dalit Soga and the surrounding community to get that particular added effort that we've put in that area. Sanitation was also a huge problem there. I mean, you can imagine the previous slide showed you the huts, and we've put those JoJo water tanks there, which actually harvest the rainwater to drinkable water and also runs that sanitation center there. That's generally us in summary of the IDT. We've had some with that, and we wish to confirm that we believe that working together we can do much more than what you've seen here. I think if we work together with the honorable delegates here, the impact of the IDT would be greater, and we could potentially change the lives of our people. Thank you.
Chair, maybe just to conclude by saying this is the school that for years in January it will come out of the newspapers, the state of South Africa schools, that it used to come, but I'm thinking the last 2 years we've not seen that picture. We have rolled out the program which we are completing currently. We will be having our annual report on the 26th, which is Monday, in one of the schools that we've also built through this program in Limpopo. And we'd invite honorable members, if it's possible, to join us there so that you can be able to witness the IDT at work. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim, for the presentation. Honorable members, let me give you an opportunity to interact with the presentation given. Quite detailed. A lot of detail has been provided in this presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I believe the IDT is doing a lot of work, and they are, if you listen to them, they are also doing good work. But I'm always worried when I'm visiting schools, especially in the province where I'm coming from, the northwest. I do not know how many schools you built in that area, but the quality of schools is not always good. And I want to know from you, when you build schools, hospitals, and all that things, do you have a quality control? Do you have people who control the buildings and after they finished it and to give a clearance, a certificate to the school and say that the school is safe and everything is fine? Because they are schools. I'm visiting them, and then the schools are 2-3 years old and they're falling apart. So the quality is very, very bad. And I do not know what is your involvement in such schools and what is your procedure you followed after finished a school. And then my next question, Chair, is about the subsidies you've got from various institutions. You've got donors, and you've also mentioned that the presentation you've got from certain institutions. I want to know which company or institution are your biggest donor. Because when you you must have to interact with the if you're in school programs, with education in a certain province. So is the education department the donor of you, or how is it working? If you build hospitals, is health a donor? Are they subsidized you, or how is it working? Are you working through them? If you can just give us a bit more clarity about that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also join in echoing the appreciation of the substance of the report.
Chair, on a lighter note, I'm not sure what the CEO is going to actually note when she goes back home, because I was to say public works is notorious of delaying projects because of assuring quality. They will always make the contractor demolish from time to time in trying to ensure quality. But to the contrary, Honorable Kronemal has got his own perception around his province, but I'm talking Eastern Cape. Now, coming to Afghisa, I'm more interested on Afghisa Eastern Cape. I'm happy if IDT is saying to us they are the primary, I would want to use the term primary, the primary agent for driving the Afghisa program. And it seems now to be more of theory than practice. Look at, for instance, the Umzimvubu water catchment program in the Eastern Cape. It's not moving at all. But, you know, meetings are sitting, people are flying around, money being spent, planning for planning, no implementation, just planning. The other one is jobs for growth. Jobs for growth. I noted that one with interest. Maybe, Chairperson, some of the questions that we have may not necessarily be answered today. Maybe IDT will have to go back and make a breakdown per province and possibly down per municipality around. Because I captured them well when they were talking of the redistributive mechanism. If a province-wide kind of a template around that, with targets following that METF, plan, that this is what they are targeting in terms of jobs for growth. I'm saying, Chair, that one, I'm not actually pinning them down that they should give us answers now if they are not ready. Chair, there is also this program on dealing with mud and infrastructure. If you look at the Eastern Cape, it's number one there, that template. And one would want to have an interest as to how far. We had a provincial meeting, and I asked the same question to the MEC for the Journal of Education as to what is that in place for dealing with that crisis, particularly in the eastern part of the Eastern Cape, the former Transkei area. Because, you know, look at what has been allocated to the whole department budget. It doesn't seek to go towards addressing without need. And one understands that this report made the CEO didn't want to report all the bad things. She wanted to give only the good things. She didn't talk to the cost recovery frustrations that various ITT are experiencing. And I would be interested to know, particularly from this case, your cash flow vis-a-vis your implementation plan, how is it frustrated? Is it smooth? I'm raising this because I've got a particular reference to two schools, wherein I know that if we can go to Makaula Senior Secondary School now, I was there with Honorable Jeff George, sometime last year, and we said we'll do 1, 2, 3 in that school. But to date, nothing has happened because funds are not flowing from the Department of Education to ITT. You go to Bonda Junior Secondary School, also in the Eastern Cape. These two schools are in Mount Frank. Also, we have said that school, the Department of Education was saying they want to open that school now that ITT has finished. But we are saying ITT has done its part, but the renovation part of it, and we know that the promise was made that the department would pump in more funds to put the whole school in shape. It's not happening. So if we could get those frustrations so that we assist ITT when we meet the Department of Education, because we're always there. It's only that, Chairperson, that I would want to ask. Thanks.
No, thank you very much, especially with regard to the last question you asked. It would be good if beyond Eastern Cape are given a global picture of the kind of frustrations that you experience, so that when we deal with issues, we then have a broader picture. Honorable Silver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Only two or three would like to ask. If we go back to the vision and mission of IDT, the vision to build a leading knowledge-based development agency. I would like to know, as far as the core business areas is concerned, we all know that the municipalities are in shambles. The third point on your core business area is to institutional delivery capacity building. Right, there's municipal support programs. I would like to know the support program. If I take the year spent between 1990, when IDT was established, up to now it's 9 years. So I think there could be a remarkable influence on it as well. And there's another one also concerning the municipalities. Let's just get to it. Your advocacy. You also mentioned the municipal anti-poverty plan and commitments to targets. Can you maybe just give us a briefing on that as well? Because as we see what happened with municipalities, are you playing a leading role there? Are you educating? I think you should have concentrated on that as well. Just give us a feedback. What are you actually doing with the municipalities? Or what did you do with them, please? Appreciate it. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much, Honorable Pilsman. And maybe before we give the CEO to respond, let me just to pick up on one or two things. I think my province will definitely want me to account if I don't raise this. There's a pie chart. I can't find it now in the hard copy. Where is it? The achievements, under your achievements. I see that the Northern Cape, you've got a 0% of achievements. It would be good that one just get a sense of why is 0%? Is it because of there's no interaction? Is the province not utilizing the services of IDT? Or is, maybe one can just get a sense of
of what could be the real problem there. And then the second issue would be there's a tie also dealing, or is it a prior chat or a statement from the CEO, not the CEO, CFO, on finance, on rental office rental. I find it quite interesting to observe that the mandate of Public Works is to mobilize office space, maintenance, all those things. Four departments, basically saying that it becomes the custodian of offices and so forth. And now, an institution that has got for which its executive authority is the Department of Public Works still pays rent. I'm not saying it's wrong, but if one can get a sense of why wouldn't the department take responsibility of ensuring that it houses you throughout the provinces and nationally? I think that kind of clarity would also be interesting to know. You make an observation that your part of the review work done by Treasury on DFI proved that you are relevant and very strategic and maybe relevant also in the future. But you don't give us a sense, except for the last part where the CEO speaks of the memos that have been sent to the executive or to cabinet. Why only now? Why is it that Treasury has not been supportive? Because it's important that we get to know, because it's linked to that element of frustration. The answer said beyond the Eastern Cape, we can get a global picture. Are you getting the necessary support from Treasury? Are you getting the necessary support from the Department of Public Works? If it is a matter that is only happening now, why now? And to what extent can we now, as members sitting in this committee, be sure that you are definitely going to get the necessary support? Is there a political will from the department, in particular Public Works and Treasury, to really moving into the direction of ensuring that your mandate remains relevant as we move forward? So it would be good if one can get that sense. That's one thing. The emphasis, which is quite a good, I mean, there's no way that we can even question that. The extent to which DTI wants to move into fighting and defeating or eradicating this chronic intergenerational poverty, which I think all of us, even as members of Parliament, would not even hesitate to give an effort in supporting that kind of a program. Linked to that, you speak to provincial anti-poverty strategies. Now, I couldn't, maybe you limited yourself with the detail around that to say, at a national level, this is what you have. At a provincial level, these are the anti-poverty strategies that you have. Which provinces are these? What is the effectiveness? What kind of progress are we making at that particular level? Because when you spoke of the anti-poverty, anti-chronic intergenerational poverty, anti-poverty provincial strategy, my first question was, does the Northern Cape have one? Because I've never heard of a provincial one, except for your national one. But the way it is presented, it may give an impression that all provinces do have anti-poverty strategies, effective, and all those things. So if one can get a sense also on that aspect. Honorable Groenewald, you wanted to come back and support the Department of Public Works in terms of quality. Okay.
I want to do it, but it's not always possible. Yes, see, if we are looking into the vision and mission of IDT, nothing is mentioned about the creation of jobs. So it is basically service delivering to a certain community on a certain time. But if we are looking on page 15, analysis of cost for 2011. This hard copy. On page 15. If you look at that diagram there, you said 53.9% is staff cost. So I'm a bit worried about that. If we can change the staff cost and goods and services, but because goods and services are 35.9%, and I think it's good practice to, when we are looking to staff cost, that is around about 30-35%. And this is, now you've got less money to deliver services in communities because a lot of this money is going to staff. And I want to know, why is it in that way at this stage, or in 2011, if you projected it forward? If you can just explain this to us, thank you very much.
So I don't know how you're going to, but you'll guide us.
Thank you, Chair. My team will respond. Chair will assist each other, and the remedies may ask Eden to start, and then Mitsito and Tom, and then I'll conclude. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe I have to pass to the last question by Honorable Kunderbaum, and just to say that what we presented to you was
what we presented with the strategic plan, but I just put a slide up there on our annual report, and so I think what the CFO was presenting was how we apply our budget, because I think that is what we are counting for our operational budget for the year. But through our program budget, I think that we've done fairly well in terms of over 53,500 short-term jobs that were created last year. So I think that is a particular dimension that doesn't necessarily come through in this presentation on the strategic plan. On the first question which Honorable Groenewald asked about do we do quality control, and our response is a very confident and definite yes. Our business model is structured such that we, in fact, just on Thursday, we spent the day in the field visiting schools in Gauteng. So there would be a consulting engineer who in all of the social infrastructure programs who would be advising, for example, on landfills and gradients of the land. I don't understand all of those things. I learned a little bit on Thursday. And then we would have a principal engineer, which normally is a civil engineer, who signs off the work of the contractor. And the consulting engineer would also, the issue around clearance certificates, yes, that is happened. That happens. That is normal, and that is standard practice. And I think that we can say that with the majority of our programs that we do, we can stand back proudly. I think Dali Soka that we showed was handed over in 2008, and we can tell you can go there tomorrow unannounced, and we don't have to be embarrassed. But there are examples where contractors take shortcuts. We visited a school in a very underprivileged municipality in Gauteng, the Rietvallei School, the first high school that borders and services an informal settlement. The community were really proud and pleased and owned this asset because previously these poor people, people with limited resources, had to pay to get their children to high schools. The school was fine when it was handed over 2 years ago, and when we went there on Friday with part of our effort to attempt to problem solve, we saw unacceptable quality faults, you know, like plaster chipping off at the windows or the paving where people have to walk, children have to walk is not okay, or where the drainage was a fine. But we had in the room there the consulting engineer, we had the principal engineer, and we had the contractor, and really got to the bottom of now who is responsible for what and what do you plan to do about it. And we were able to extract out of them, because why must we use our own resources to do the corrective action, or why should we go back to government to do the corrective action when we can hold people accountable? So we've extracted the commitment that the quality faults that are there must be sorted out so that learners and educators can operate in a conducive environment when we come to the start of the financial year. And then there are structural problems that will take a longer time. So I agree with you that there are instances where there are quality faults, and I give Rietvallei to you as an example, and also that we do something about it. Does that answer the question? How do subsidies flow from donors, and who are our biggest donors? We would refer to the CEO and the CFO refers to our turnover. Now, what typically happens is that the department would enter into an agreement with the department to do a program of work for them. So we would refer to such departments as our clients. So I think it's safe to say that the Department of Education is our biggest client, because you can see from that pie diagram that school building constitutes our biggest portfolio. But you will also see from the other little pie diagram where we had, let me just put it up. I think it's the one before this. After this. Well, you can see the different kinds of the one in the corner here, that there would also be a significant a number of health facilities. You'll see EPWP there. There's EPWP. There was very little EPWP last year. It would be bigger for the current year, etc. Our donors, then we have private sector partners, which the CEO has spoken about. That has been very few. I think Lonmin has been our one example. There's another one which is on the cards, and I'm not sure if we had liberty to speak about it yet until we have the agreement in hand, but CEO, you can talk to that. But it's an area where we believe you would see that we said in our business model, I mean, there's a huge amount of corporate social investment fund. I think our last, a couple of years ago, it was standing at about 7 billion, and of which only 25% goes into sport. And the others are there that we believe that corporate South Africa, just in terms of their scorecard, do want to commit in sustainable or invest in sustainable development, but don't know how to do it. And so we're setting ourselves up to be able to support that. The member is right that public works does ensure quality, because typically, I mean, Public Works has reasserted its mandate in terms of infrastructure delivery. So typically, although it will be Department of Education's budget, but the agreement would be between IDT and the Provincial Department of Public Works. It would almost be a tripartite agreement. So before the money is released for schools or for health facilities, it would be Public Works also being satisfied with that and recommending to the host department, education or health, potentially to be releasing that. In terms of Asgisa, I don't know if one of the other colleagues can speak more specifically about the provincial Asgisa task teams. We're aware of the task team in the Eastern Cape, but you will also, Honourable Memor, will also know, or maybe we need to say that we were asked to support the presidency with Asgisa in 2006, and Asgisa included the Jobs for Growth program, but we were not given any funding for it because we understood at the time that it was a program that was being announced without a budget being available. Then we supported the department, the presidency, with a budget submission, and that the budget submission or the budget was never allocated to us. It was distributed differently. We know that in the different provinces, we assisted with the establishment of provincial clusters. In terms of Jobs for Growth, that had the same fate. Jobs for Growth did not receive funding. In last year, Cabinet recognized the value of Jobs for Growth. And somewhere on my machine, I could show you what the business model was and what some of the targets were for Jobs for Growth, but we will happily send it to you subsequently as the member has proposed. What Cabinet decided last year was that Jobs for Growth is a valuable vehicle in terms of job creation, sustainable job creation, enterprise development, and so forth, and that the program must be reintroduced and that the program should be implemented by the IDT. What has not been decided yet is the budget that is available, so the program has not been reintroduced with its funding. But we expect that it would happen because, in our view, it supports the strategic priority one of creating economic growth, sustainable decent work, and sustainable livelihoods. I'm sure the CEO can speak about the frustrations around cost recovery and cash flows, etc. Fukani, are you going to speak about the municipalities? Or maybe I should just say what we have put in there in terms of our core business and what we plan to do. Remember, we are talking about our strategic plan. This is a lot of this is our planning and the observation by the member on the other side. You've been doing this for 15 years. No, we have not been doing municipal support for 15 years. As the CEO explained, we only became a public entity in 1998, and I think local government was introduced in 2000, the current form that we have now. And we also very mindful of the fact that municipalities is a critical sphere of delivery. However, there are departments which has municipal delivery and capacity building as their core mandate, such as the Department of Cooperative Governance. However, we have, through the ISRDP, we have done a number, have had a number of successes with our municipal programs. A few years back, for example, we supported the then DPLG with developing economic profiles and investment profiles that could facilitate mobilization of funds for municipalities. We have we support the ISRDP and the rural nodes in particular with their IDPs. We developed a methodology called the what we call the local area planning framework, and what that addresses is the leg of civil community participation in the development of LAPs. And an interesting bit of data, and this was so by the 31st of March, and we have to test what I'm going to share with you, because the communities are involved and ward councillors are involved in planning. The municipalities where we have worked, we don't have unrest because people have a voice and one has one. There is a functional relationship. However, it is in very few municipalities. We did it again in that performance report that I said showed you. We did LAPs in three district municipalities, in all of the wards of three district municipalities. I think members will appreciate if you think of the number of wards that a district municipality would have, that is quite substantial. And it costs us between 400,000 and 500,000 rand per LAP to be able to do that. So we do that to be able to demonstrate to the municipality the value, but we also bring ward councillors and we bring municipal officials on board so that they are able to do that more effectively next time. Then we've also introduced municipal support programs in 9 municipalities, but in those municipalities where we have done LAPs, so we are able to deepen the impact as opposed to a little bit everywhere. So again, I think we are experimenting with a particular model of capacity building at municipal level, and with these kinds of interventions, you're not going to see the results in a year's time. It takes time. In the same way, we have a contractor development program where we're targeting only 45 women contractors. And again, we say that will take, after 3 or 5 years, you will be able to see that. But one of the indicators would be, have these contractors been able to move from their CIDB grading to a different grading and that they are able to do better business now? On Northern Cape, Chair, I think it is the way in which you'll see in the previous graph, I would also be concerned if I were from the Northern Cape, but you'll see in this graph, Northern Cape contributed 0.7% towards our total target. And in this pie diagram, I think it evened out the percentages to whole numbers, and that is why it looked like that. But then, I think on the scale of things, Chair, I don't know what the percentages are, but Northern Cape does get the smallest portion of the equitable share. And what this turnover reflects here is the amount, these totals speak to the business, the value of the agreements that we entered into with the different provinces. And because Northern Cape has the smallest budget available, Northern Cape I think those programs, and my colleagues can assist me, I think those in fact we might be for national programs. If we do have a program with the Northern Cape Department, it is a very small program. because the Northern Cape province has always said to us, because of their small budgets and they have an infrastructure of public servants available in the province, they don't necessarily have the need of an IDT in terms of supporting them with program management. So, and which is a bit of a contradiction, because if you look again at the actual the rollovers and the extent to which the province is not able to spend, there's a bit of a contradiction. And so I think that now, if you see the expenditure there, we were able to expend all of what we were committed to, but I think that is for justice programs mainly. And again, the CFO can just confirm that. CEO, maybe that is the one that I can say.
Having said that, Chair, I think your question is quite pertinent around the Northern Cape in particular. You see, we've been trying to develop our business case, and our own estimation is that it costs far much more to do business in the Northern Cape than anywhere else. You would know, Honorable Chair, the distances are sparsely populated. I'd like to link that with the question of the Honorable Groenewald. Because you see, the job that we do, if we do the local area planning, it requires myself or another facilitator to sit with the community literally and collect the information. It would be nice if I could just send a tape recorder. So, you know, the business that we're really in is a highly labor-intensive business, highly costly in terms of time, in terms of travel. And these are the kinds of human resources that are very difficult to maintain. And that's why when you look at that pie chart, it looks wrong. But it's quite correct for the type of business that we're in, because it's about a people's business. I would want to directly answer the Honorable Delegate from the Eastern Cape around ASCISA, Eastern Cape. I think you are raising a particular issue around ASCISA, Eastern Cape. It is an issue that we've engaged with. We've looked at all the project areas around that development triangle. And last week, if I'm not mistaken, last week Monday, we entered into an agreement with ASCISA Eastern Cape. Next week, Wednesday and Thursday, we're sitting down and doing the type of work I was referring to, looking at all your plans and then saying, okay, what's step one, what's step two, what's step three, and then putting that into an implementation plan. I think the Honorable Delegate, if we can exchange details, then I'll be able then to share with you what are the plans looking like around that ASCISA Eastern Cape delivery. But we are working with them now, and we have an agreement around that. Related to that is the jobs for growth. And yes, you know, the overall budgets are not existent and so forth, but the intents of the program are still intact, and I think that's what my colleague was saying. And there we've also then entered into agreement with the investor for 10. Because the idea, then you can link it with ASCISA Eastern Cape. The idea is that once you actually find the economic development opportunity, you need normal South African citizens to take them up, not myself who's in the middle class. You need the local villagers to be the ones that participate in those opportunities. And then the models that we're working on with the Investor Forte and the Department of Labor is around cooperatives, developing cooperatives that can take those opportunities up and then sustain their own development. So those are kind of related, two separate agreements that they will merge into one. I think that was a specific one. I wish not to address the issues that the Honorable Delegate wants us to lead us to around what the frustrations are with Eastern Cape education. I think that's a specific one. And I think the Delegate is more informed than me around the dynamics of the Eastern Cape and the developments in the Eastern Cape. But I think I want to turn the question around and see how the Honorable Delegate could assist us to actually unlock those challenges that we're facing in the Eastern Cape around the delivery of those. I think the Honorable Delegate is far more and has got better context than ourselves to actually try and unravel that. In terms of the municipal support program,
because you see that's where the problem comes. That's where the problem comes. Because over and above our constitutional mandate of bringing, profiling local and provincial interests at the national. We do have a national mandate as well, in terms of the constitution of the Republic. So it shouldn't be an issue of the Eastern Cape. I've got an interest. You must have an interest of what is happening in the Northern Cape. Because we pass budgets here. We debate those budgets in the House. And before this House passes and adopts that budget, it cannot be regarded as having been passed by Parliament. So we've got a responsibility to do oversight on that. So once we raise the issue, I then took it further and said, give us a global picture beyond the Eastern Cape as well, where you're experiencing the same problems, because it assists us. That's the only way we can be better positioned to assist you. But if we don't know this thing, it's going to be now corridor politics. Because now after the meeting, and I'll go into it, they tell me what is happening in the West, in the Eastern Cape. You know? So it's not a process of Parliament. It's not a meeting where we got information and agreed on how to process it. So it would be important, but of course, if people's names are involved and all that, we can agree on a separate process. But if there are principal issues that you think are quite important for us to know, this is a better platform, Abdullah.
Okay. Thank you for your guidance, Honorable Chair. Let me defer to the CFO, because I think he'll have greater details around what the challenges are and how to unlock those challenges. So I think the CFO will have greater detail than myself around that particular area. I wanted to address also the issue of the Minister Support Program and those challenges, because, and again, it relates to that slide of staff, you know, that 53%. You see, we can only get to 9 municipalities simply because we don't have enough people to go to all those municipalities on one level. Now, what we've done to address that is then begin to interact with organizations such as the DBSA, who are in fact having also a municipal support program, you know, I think it's 35 municipalities, where they're giving engineers and so forth. So we're working together with them in the context of EPWP and the Senza Manja program, so that then we can expand that outlook around the municipal support program. I think, CEO, those are the specific ones that I can address, and maybe the CFO would wish to address the big question.
A big question, because honestly, what we want here is I want when the CEO comes in to be clear. When we do oversight, look on the Madiba day, it was the day when I visited these two schools. I had a session with the committee in one school and a session in another. The blame is not put to the department, neither public works nor education. The blame is put to IDT. And correctly speaking, because I know the process, I know that IDT doesn't own money. You are just an agent. You know, I couldn't say that to that committee, but I said, I will come back to you with explanation. So that's when and how we get to know that there is frustration. So it's not about witch hunting. Hence, the Honourable Chairperson is saying, you need not necessarily be specific, but just go wide, so that we from the various provinces can know, so that when we pose questions to the various departments, we're able to be generic in approach, not necessarily specific. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think it's important for me to maybe highlight the financial model that we operate. I think a lot of the questions and the challenges will really become clear if that explanation is on the table. I think it will also talk to your request in terms of cooperation or non-cooperation of departments, which impacts positively or negatively in terms of our actual delivery on the ground. Chair, I think it's the financial model that we operate works on the basis of PIAs, a program implementation agreement that we conclude with a department. In that PIA, we will, for instance, sign a contract of $100 million to build X number of schools. The financial arrangements in that agreement says that the department will make available that $100 million as and when the cash flow requirements are on the table. In other words, if we predict within the next 2 months we will need $15 million, we give that request to the department for them to make the cash available for us to enable us to pay the contractors or the professionals that we have procured through our procurement processes. Historically, we've had a good track record in the sense that departments had money available, and when we requested our cash flow advances, they responded quickly and timeously for us to have that cash available. Also, just to note that when departments make cash available to us, we actually deposit that cash into a dedicated departmental account. And all the interest earned on that money actually goes back to the department. IDP does not make 1 cent of money from those cash advances. The only revenue that we receive is a percentage, which we call a management fee, which we agree to upfront when the contract is concluded. And normally we concluded that percentage not on a full cost recovery basis, but we actually contracted historically on a nominal amount of, on average, 2% of the project value. Now, I think the problem comes in from a quality perspective. Firstly, through the cooperation and agreement of the department. As Edith has highlighted, we work with professional people, and we rely on the actual certification of work. Now, the initial contract, once again, my example, $100 million, is based on QS estimates for that project. Now, I also know of one particular example in the Northwest Province where when they did the foundations, the engineers came up and they said, we need special reinforcement for the foundation, otherwise we cannot structurally sign it off. The IDT people agreed, and we actually went ahead with it. Because of a time delay to actually just produce the VO, the variance certificate, to the department suddenly started arguing now. They don't want to pay for the reinforcement of the foundations, et cetera, because we waited too late. Now the foundations are already done. And it's a quality issue which we're not willing to sacrifice. You know, we cannot build a structure on foundations which are not safe. So there are these kind of challenges that you also encounter from time to time, and it's based on the professional recommendations from the professionals involved. I think what we're also finding lately, Chairperson, is cash is becoming scarcer. And I think departments are becoming cash strapped. When we now put our cash flow requirements on the table, you find the departments coming up with all kinds of excuses why the money cannot be released in time because of their own challenges that they're having. But it also puts the IDT in an enormously difficult position because we're sitting with contractual obligations with contractors and consultants. We're sitting with liabilities for these people who've already performed. And if we do not get that cash in time, we are seriously exposed in terms of threats, in terms of interest being charged, and even legal prosecution that's also on the table at the moment. And it's really a very, very difficult situation to manage. I think that in essence explains the challenges. The department's cash flow, cash-strapped situation is actually flowing through to the IDT. And yes, it is impacting on the actual delivery on the ground. And It is causing delays, which we also do not want to tender. Chair, one of the other issues which was also mentioned, the issue of cost recovery. When the board took a decision that we will have to do full cost recovery on all government mandated programs, we found different levels of cooperation from different departments. Some departments said, yes, we 100% agree, we're willing to go that way with you. Other departments took the position to say that you've been institutionalized or you've been funded by a government, why should we pay you to do this job? It's your job. We're not going to pay you anything. Other departments said, yes, we're willing to pay you 2%, but full cost recovery, 5%, no, that's too much. We're not going to pay you that. So it's a very difficult thing to generalize, and it's a very difficult thing to actually, in terms of stakeholder engagement, convince everybody at the same level that a full cost recovery in terms of the sustainability of the IDT is actually a non-negotiable if we want to have this institution for future impact. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, honorable members. I will start... visitors to say we appreciate this feedback from the ground because you have got the constituencies there, and maybe to encourage members to give us this feedback because sometimes we might not be aware of some of the issues that are happening on the ground, i.e. I want to refer to the quality of work, for instance, to say that maybe somewhere we might not be aware of those schools. So if such you come across that, please don't hesitate to give us that so that we can check and see if it is our fault or not. I'm aware that, for instance, in Northwest, it is not all the schools that were done by the IDT, but those that were done by the IDT were prepared to resolve the issues if there are issues that that are coming out of that. But secondly, honorable members, just to say that in terms of the quality of schools, what Edith was saying, let me give an example that in Gauteng, we were given about 29 schools to implement. 25 of those schools were very well done. 4 of those schools had problems. And these are the problems that Edith was referring to in terms of Rift Valley and the fact that we are resolving those problems and making sure that those schools are also functional. But I also must hasten to say that part of our targets and how we are measured as an organization is the empowerment target. And I want to believe that whenever you pursue empowerment, to some extent there is also a cost attached to it. It might be a cost in terms of delay. It might be a cost in terms of financial cost. And therefore, we know that there is a risk that we take in terms of lifting up the empowerment and as well as some of the capacity building programs that we put in place. So we do accept where there are faults, but our approach is to say, how do we resolve this? What are the corrective actions that we're putting in place? Because if we do not risk, honorable members, there is no way that there will ever be empowerment. We do need to take some risk, to some extent, exposure and accessibility so that we can be able to achieve some of those empowerment targets. The CFO has responded to the issues of the service delivery model, but I also want to just come in terms of the cost recovery. When we started the discussions with Treasury on the business case, one of the things that Treasury mentioned to us was that we are actually distorting their accountability processes. How are we distorting that? When we sign the PIAs and departments don't want us to recover the program management cost, which has been allocated into the fiscus. What happens is that that money remains in the books of the client. At the end of the financial year, it could be declared as a rollover. When actually it's an artificial rollover, it's a savings. Because we have incurred that cost, that the honorable member, for instance, was talking to say that our costs are high. It's high because we need people to be able to implement those jobs and we're not cost recovery. That is when we started interacting with Treasury in terms of our business model. Now, we are saying we need to begin to reverse that. Because if those costs have been provided in the fiscal, we then need to recover those costs. But as the CFO is saying, in some departments there is resistance in terms of recovery of those costs. And I can say, honorable member, that the Eastern Cape is one of those provinces where we're unable to recover costs. We're still in discussions in terms of whether we can be able to recover costs. So part of our business model and our business case that we are pursuing is to correct all those issues, honourable members. And we are accepting that some of it maybe we have delayed in correcting it. One of the things that we had also requested from the executive authority was a cabinet memo to go to cabinet to resolve that the IDT will cost recover for the services that we are giving to departments. But it doesn't mean that that has not been budgeted for. It has been budgeted for. And therefore, you might find that we are distorting the accountability processes. We are hoping, honourable members, that the processes that we have entered into now will be able to correct those distortions. In terms of the our relationship with the departments of public works in provinces, let me say again, we have taken an initiative to sign a protocol of agreement. There has been a perception created that the IDT is in competition with the Department of Public Works. And we thought that it is very important that we address this issue head on and begin to make our executive authority at provincial level that we are there to complement. We are there to assist with capacity because we have been able now to mobilize that capacity. Our minister, I must commend our minister and thank him very much because he has been spearheading that process. He has actually been through all the road shows that he has done in the province, assisted us to make sure that provinces understand that the IDT is there to complement. My colleague had said that when you go to private companies, for instance, to go and build a school in Dalisoga, you will pay 3 or 4 times as much. One, because of accessibility. It is not accessible. So which means you must get material from very far to go there and implement. Hence, you find that most of the projects that are in the most rural areas, no one touches those programs. The IDT is able to get to those programs. So I think these are the advantages that we're saying to our provincial departments, let us partner and be able to fast-track the implementation of service delivery. I'm going to move on. I know my colleagues have been able to respond to some of the issues, and correctly so, in terms of Eastern Cape, there's a lot of improvement in terms of our working relationship, as my executive has said. But I just wanted to touch on why is it that the Jobs for Growth is a unique program of government. Honourable members are aware that there are a number of structures that attempt to create small enterprises. But most of those structures, they actually exclude the people that we are targeting. The Jobs for Growth, we intentionally called it the Jobs for Growth because it is targeting the poorest of the poor. It is targeting the woman that is sitting at the gate of the school and selling fat cakes. If you go to most of the funding institutions that we have currently, you'll find that the requirements for them to participate into those programs, it actually excludes them automatically. One example that I normally put forward is the example of the school feeding scheme. Honorable members know that there were a lot of women that were feeding their children, was actually been fed by that, most of us, of those markets where they would be selling fat cakes at the gate of the school. When the school feeding scheme came, and then there were had to be contracts, tendering, and certain requirements, those women lost business because it was the big businesses that were able to capture that market. What Jobs for Growth does, therefore, is that it targets... honourable members, I want to say, therefore, honourable members, this is a very unique program that I would want to urge members that this program must be revived. This program must come back. We don't have a program right now, as I speak, that targets this level of people. And without the Jobs for Growth, we will not be able to dent this intergenerational poverty that we are talking about. The redistributive mechanism that we spoke to, I agree with honourable members. Yes, we have said that we are a redistributive organ of the state, and therefore we can be able to give you that table per province in terms of what type of programs we have. As my colleague has said, we didn't have it, we don't have it here, but we can definitely provide it to you. The type of programs and where those programs are located in each of the provinces. The honourable member also asked about how far are we with the MAT schools. The MAT schools that were directly funded by the IDT are actually complete. I think we've got two schools that are outstanding, which also will be completed by the end of October. But in terms of the math schools, in the 150 million that was allocated, we've completed those math schools. But I also want to come back on the issue that you have raised in terms of the allocation of government on the 2.8 billion rand budget for math schools. The IDT is not implementing all of those schools. Once more, when we did the bid, it is the IDT that did the bid, that did that costing and took it to Treasury. When Treasury allocated the resources were allocated to provinces, which means the IDT does not have a direct access to those resources. So we now again rely on the provinces to appoint the IDT. There are provinces that appointed the IDT to roll out the program. There are provinces that did not appoint the IDT. And therefore, we cannot be accountable for those because we don't have the resources to roll out that. One of the things that our minister has been doing was to urge provinces to appoint the IDT. Actually, we're seeing, possibly we're going to be seeing rollovers of money not spent on that, which I would say those are the schools that my colleague is putting up there. But you will find that these are the provinces where we have been appointed to do the math schools from the 2.8 billion. And there are a number of other provinces that had not appointed us to do that. So just to give honourable members a picture of where we are operating in as far as this program is concerned. So one of the things that we can ask the committee to assist us with is that this in our analysis was a very prioritised program. If that program was maybe treated as a conditional grant and had a dedicated implementer, possibly we might be talking something else now in terms of how far we have gone with the implementation of that program. The issue of challenges in provinces, I do appreciate what honourable members are saying, and I think it is important that we highlight to you the principal issues that do challenge us in provinces. I mean, we have referred, for instance, in the issue of the Eastern Cape, and the issues of budget are real. We have not been able to fast-track the implementation as much as we have wanted because there were no resources. I think at the beginning of the financial year, if I'm not mistaken, colleagues, it took us about 6 months to even start with new programs because there was no money that had been transferred to our coffers. But I must also hasten to say the change of leadership in provinces also does have an effect. And unless we look at that, because each time there's a new leadership that comes into provinces, we have to start with renegotiation. Some of the programs are actually stopped. In Mpumalanga, we were appointed to implement about 1.2 billion worth of schools. And we only implemented less than 100 million because when the new executive authority came in, they stopped those programs. And there was an appointment of a different service provider. Now, these are all the things that ultimately contribute towards service delivery. And I feel that as IDT, as a development agent, it is very important that we highlight some of these challenges because unless you intervene at the level of the legislature to try and assist us in addressing this, we will be talking about service delivery all the time. The issue of rental of offices, I thought my CFO will talk to that, but as per the Schedule 2 entity, the nature of what the IDT is, I think our department, which is the executive authority, has not necessarily assisted us with offices. But I think I appreciate the thought, honourable member, because we'll go back to them. If there are offices where we can be able to use that maybe Public Works is not using, we can be able to consider that, in particularly in provinces where most of the time we struggle to get a suitable office space. The honourable members also spoke about the DFI review. That it confirms that the IDT is relevant in terms of its mandate, but what about the capitalisation? I think honourable members were here to say we are requesting your support. If the IDT is not recapitalized, as we've projected to yourself, we need to begin to start thinking about closing down the IDT. And what we have done was to look into, if the IDT was non-existent, what is South Africa going to lose? And we've got a story to tell in terms of what South Africa can lose. And we want to put forward to yourself as the custodian of that social policy objectives and the MTSF that we are there as IDT with the necessary capacity to be able to drive some of these programs. And let me also say, honorable members, it is not that we have just put it now, but we started in 2005 when we started driving our business case. But I think it's only now that the minister is able to say we can present to cabinet. And we would like to just ask honorable members to scrutinize what comes to your way in terms of whether the IDT is accommodated into the next fiscal. Honorable members also spoke to the intergenerational poverty strategies in provinces. Do all the provinces have those strategies? A very relevant question, honorable member. And my response is that we are planning that we will actually proactively go to the provinces and try and get them to focus on putting together the anti-poverty strategy. There are provinces where we've done that. I think we've done that in Mpumalanga. We've participated in the Eastern Cape, but it is definitely Free State. But it is definitely not all the provinces where we have participated. Let me also say, honorable member, that maybe to urge you to say that we can't wait for the National Anti-Poverty Strategy to be concluded, because it would be very good that it can also be a bottom-up approach, that we also need those guidelines at national level. We are not sure how far that strategy is. We've been participating in its formulation, but we are awaiting the conclusion of that from cabinet. Lastly, honourable members, we have spoken about the percentage of staff costs, and I think my colleagues have tried to respond to that. We are a very labour-intensive organisation. We believe that when we interact with people, you need people to be able to do that. So our work, what we sell is the expertise. When we talk about program management as an organisation, we are talking about firstly a scarce resource in South Africa generally, and we need to be able to pay for that scarce resource. But what we have done was to come up with a model to say that, for instance, there are certain core competencies that we would want to centralize at head office. As such, if we can further break down those costs, you would realize that at head office, actually our costs are even higher. And that is intentional. We have thought that if we can be able to decentralize those costs or that expertise in regions, it will cost us even more. So let's rather centralize, and we will deploy as and when required. So you find that, for instance, we've got a core of competencies that service the whole nation in terms of the requirements of our different offices. So we do agree, but we also want to say that it is a necessary cost that we need to retain. Otherwise, we will be compromising what is core in terms of the impact of the organization. I want to assume, honorable members, that we have tried to respond to all your questions, but if we have not, once more, we do have that information, and it will not be a problem for us to send that information to us, even if there are other issues that we might not have covered. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, CEO. In actual fact,
just to say, we're giving the committee secretary a copy of the presentation on the memory sheet, but also there's a little narrative report on the MUD score that can be circulated, as well as information on the IDT addresses and regional general managers' names and contact details in the provinces. So if in your provinces you need to contact somebody specifically, we're giving that information to the secretary, so you have that information.
No, thank you very much, Prof. I just thought of even raising that members should also use this detailed report, because it does provide a lot of information. No, CEO and honorable members, by way of closing, I think it was quite an informative engagement or interaction with the IDT and MUD. And just to make the point, you know, I found it quite interesting when the professor responded to the Northern Cape situation.
because just in 2007, I think it's 2007, was the hospital recapitalization program. The Eastern Cape proved to be incapable of utilizing the resources allocated to the Eastern Cape. And the then minister, Msima, then resolved to redirect the resources to the Northern Cape, because the Northern Cape was then ready and said they are capable of delivering on the hospital recapitalization program. And it's quite clear that you were not engaged, you were not involved, because as we're speaking today, having proved or projected themselves or itself as a province that is capable, we still have a hospital in DR that has not even started. 2007 or in 2009. Why? Because of the question of the involvement of the private sector instead to do that kind of work. Another empirical example that one can speak to in the Northern Cape again is your mental hospital complex that the province started 3 years ago. The overall cost for the construction of that hospital was about 200 million. And I was looking at the figures there, and I saw Free State was something, 50-something. And I said, but the Northern Cape was a budget, it could come up with a project of 200 million. As we speak today, that project cannot be completed. And the costs have now escalated to way over 600 million, as we speak today. That is what came out of our provincial week when we visited the provinces and so forth. So these are some of the things that really come out when we really engage now with the provinces. And maybe also it should also come out of the DTI, Ahman, IDT, to also aggressively engage some of these provinces. Because when one looked at what really happened, especially with the construction of the hospital complex, yes, it is the Department of Health. It had budget, assigned the responsibility to public works, whatever paperwork, agreements, and all those sorts of things were signed. Why didn't public works in the province then request the services of IDT to do that kind of work for them? As we speak today, when I asked the director responsible, without mentioning his name, but can you tell me exactly what went wrong with this kind of a process? No, to be honest, Honorable Dawood, the major problem is with the tender process. It goes back to what you are refusing to respond to. Or those aspects that we know about. So it may be also, it's also a call. I think it's, what is wrong for IDT to stand up and say that we want to do this work? We are capable of doing this work. We are a developmental, we've got a developmental mandate as an institution, and we are going to do this thing much more cheaper, better quality and everything. And if, but I'm just putting this thing. You know, it's really disturbing to be seated here, and you listen to the kind of things that you're doing, that you're capable of doing, and practically on the ground, we see what is happening. It's just not fair, not for you as an institution, but for the poor. Who would have in actual fact benefited more out of a better service provided by you? So it's a call maybe on behalf of the committee to say, maybe Lilo, now you must also now try to be a little bit aggressive, you know. Not of course imposing yourself,
on the mandate or encroaching on the mandate of the others. But assert yourself, put yourself there and say, here we are, we've got a mandate, we are of a developmental institution, we share the developmental vision of this particular country, and we want to do this for the betterment of the people of South Africa. With all these programs linking them up and showing us that with this kind of a program, if we're given this job, here are women, we've got a program for empowerment, poverty, blah, 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 blah. Unlike someone who will just come in there and take 50%, if not 70%, that's his profit and it's gone. And then our people are left with poorly constructed institutions or whatever that is there, just for the sake of wanting to make a profit and becoming a quick millionaire. I was quite taken aback with what you said against what the Auditor General has been saying consistently on the middle class and so forth. And I hope we will have more middle class people who would have that thinking and move in that particular direction, because it's only then we will then have a changed a public service that is revolutionized in such a manner that a person must first see himself or as being placed there, having a strategic role to play, than to be there to look at what is it that I can quickly get out of, the javelin kind of service delivery that we have seen now, and that the Auditor General is beginning to really expose on a daily basis. So, but let me thank you very much, and hope that, of course, with this interaction, we will engage more. If there's anything that we would need for further clarity or whatsoever that we are unable to get today, I think that line of communication and so forth, we will definitely utilize it to the best of our ability. See you.
I think, Chair, I would not have done justice if I don't thank the committee for the engagement. I think we feel very encouraged. And Chairperson, just to conclude by saying maybe we didn't emphasize enough that we have actually got our seventh unqualified audit report. And, Chair, we do not compromise on the issues of governance and accountability. And despite that, we don't also compromise in terms of government. So we're able to balance that in terms of the mandate that we have been given. And with your support, Chair, we want to assure you that if you call on us, we will be able to give you the necessary information that will enable you to support us on our bid for the capitalization. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. No, thank you very much, CEO, with your team. Honourable members, just 2 minutes as we release the CEO. Just 2 quick minutes for announcements and so forth.
How are you?
Okay.
Should I stay in this one or go out as well?
I think you're supposed to stay.
I'm supposed to stay.
Yeah.
I know.
Otherwise, it's just housekeeping stuff like consideration and adoption of minutes.
Okay. So I should stay.
I think so, but I don't work for Parliament. Just from another NCO, just 8 minutes. And,
okay.
Yeah. I don't see any problem.
Okay.
Oh. Come there. Oh, sit to them.
Thank you.
let me not compromise the committee. Now, let's be fair. Honourable Member.
Yeah.
I was thinking of asking you about the issue. I would suggest that you say, we are no longer on the other side. Okay, then, that being the case, let's say thank you very much for the honourable chair. We can say,
see you tomorrow.
Yeah,
by the way, do you want
to
come on, please? Yeah, some people.
Okay, Liz.
Fine.
Okay.